Good afternoon, you are tuned into it, Juno Afternoon, here for Wednesday, the 23rd of November, the year 2016. I'm Jeff Brown, I'm here your host for today. I'm going to be talking with some young jewelry artists displaying their work at this year's public market. Also talk with me and Jeff about the market this year. We'll have Sydney Mitchell talking about downtown activities. Members of the Glacier Swim Club will be here. And we'll find out about Linda Nicklin and Flip Nicklin's presentation at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center on Friday about their trip through the Northwest Passage this summer. Matt Ryder's Almanac, Burnout Music and More today on a June afternoon. Well, the forecast for tonight, patchy freezing fog with numerous snow showers, little or no snow accumulation expected. Forecast for Thanksgiving Day, cloudy skies, patchy freezing fog, high temperatures in the mid-30s.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. People from across the country continue to travel to camps near the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe in support of the tribe's fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline. Reporter Daisha Eaton is in North Dakota and spoke with two Athabascan men from Alaska who spent some time there.
Camp organizers estimated on Monday that about 2,500 people were at all three camps combined. Some people participate in direct actions, peaceful protests near the path of the pipeline. Samuel Johns says that's where the trouble comes in. Johns, an Anchorage resident who's Otna and Gwich'in Athabascan, he says he saw demonstrators return to camp from direct actions hurt by local law enforcement.
That police brutality is real.
On Sunday, demonstrators reported being shot by law enforcement with rubber bullets and water cannons in below-freezing temperatures. John says despite the violence, the unity of the water protectors is inspiring.
It's like the way things used to be, before colonization, before capitalism. You go to Standing Rock and you'll experience something that you've never experienced in your life, but your soul and your spirit will feel at peace because it's how it used to be for us.
Fred John Jr., an Otna Athabascan elder from Delta Junction, also traveled to the camp. He helped feed campers in a makeshift kitchen while he was there. John says he's also concerned that local law enforcement are overstepping.
They come with their stick. They come with their mace against peaceful protectors, and it doesn't seem right to me. We have more right to be on that land.
John says the violence against demonstrators is troubling, but he was also impressed by the dedication of local tribes.
Opening up the camp for work and welcoming people and sharing with people.
John says once he's back in Alaska, he'll work to rally support for the Standing Rock Sioux tribe.
I hope we could get another group come down here to help out for the winter, because up in Alaska we know how to live in wintertime, and they need that help here.
The men say they hope to return to Standing Rock soon with a group to help with construction and winterization projects before the bitter North Dakota winter sets in. I'm Daisha Eaton.
The father of a woman seriously injured this week during a demonstration on a bridge in North Dakota with people opposing the Dakota Access Pipeline is urging the public to stand with the Standing Rock Sioux tribe. Wayne Wolanski says his daughter Sophia faces multiple surgeries after her arm was blown apart during a clash with police and demonstrators. He discussed his daughter's condition with reporters Tuesday in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Fox 9 News streamed the press conference.
And even though she's lying there with her arm pretty much blown off, she's focused on the fact that it's not about her. It's about what we're doing to our country, what we're doing to the Native peoples, and what we're doing to our environment.
Sophia and her father say her arm was injured by law enforcement tactics. North Dakota officials say they're aware of the claim, but say the injuries are not a direct result of any tools or weapons used by law enforcement. The 21-year-old woman from New York was at Standing Rock for 3 weeks and was planning to stay through the winter. President Obama honored the late Eloise Cobell Tuesday during a White House Medal of Freedom ceremony. Cobell led the historic Individual Indian Trust class action lawsuit against the government.
When Eloise Cobell first filed a lawsuit to recover lands and money for her people, she didn't set out to be a hero. She said, I just wanted to give justice to people that didn't have it. In her lifelong quest to address the mismanagement of American Indian lands, resources, trust funds, wasn't about special treatment, but the equal treatment at the heart of the American promise.
Her son, Turk Cobell, accepted the medal. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Support by Ramona Farms, wholesome and delicious heirloom crops for a better diet to benefit all people. Christmas delivery of foods from our centuries-old farming and culinary traditions available on orders placed by December 15th online at store.ramonafarms.com. Support by Northern Arizona University, a university committed to serving Native American students, offering opportunity in every direction, in Flagstaff, at community colleges around the state, and online. Learn more at nau.edu. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes past here, and you are tuned into a Juno Afternoon. First guest in the studio is Pete Metcalf here to talk about the public market. We also have three jewelry makers, Molly, Rucci, and Salmi, here in the studio to talk about their work. Thank you for coming down the station, everybody.
Thank you, Jeff.
So, Peter, this is the 34th annual public market.
That's right. If you multiply these girls' ages times 2.8, you get to 34. So these girls are... I was impressed by this... this business that they have going, because when Heidi Brocious, Molly's mother, sent me the photographs and application of their jewelry, I thought, another production jewelry booth. But as it turned out, they hand make their jewelry. And so we're really excited to have them as participants. Three young middle schoolers starting out in their entrepreneurial endeavors.
We'll be talking to them in just a minute, but I want to find out what gave you the impetus for starting the first public market.
What's
the impetus for starting the public market?
The Centennial Hall had just been constructed, and they were just opening, and public events were given the best rates, and it just clicked in my mind, the public market. I love the public market, Pike Place Market in Seattle, and so it wasn't too difficult to take that idea and run with it. And right away, we filled up every booth. And our first public market was in the summer of 1983. It happened to be the first time there was five cruise ships in town. We did it in the summer. And it took us another 10 years before we got as many people through the doors that weekend. So we knew we were onto a good thing.
How many vendors do you have?
Well, it varies because a lot of vendors double up or triple up, but we're thinking it's around 160 vendors this year. Every year we fill out every space available, so we usually have a waiting list, and we did this year, and we can accommodate everybody. But the vendors are coming in from all over Alaska and the Pacific Northwest. We have one vendor in from Kansas and other vendors from Hollywood and Oregon, so... You'll find, if you haven't been to a public market in a year or two, you'll find at least half the vendors entirely new to you. Every year we have at least a 30% turnover, so it keeps it fresh.
What are some older vendors and what are some brand new ones?
Well, Betty Bell, who wasn't shy about saying she's 82 on the radio earlier today, but she's probably our elder vendor. She's been coming for... going on 20 years, and I think Mark Kelly may have a longer tenure. He's been coming for 22, 24 years, but I don't think we have any original vendors left. But we've cycled through, I think, I estimate roughly 1,800 vendors over the last 34 years.
What time is it open? What are the hours?
Okay, so the public market opens on Friday at noon. We're open till 7 p.m. on Friday. On Saturday and Sunday, it's 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. And it's usually a pretty big crowd to start out. But around 4 o'clock, it starts getting fairly easy. So if you're at all crowd averse, come after four. You won't be feeling too claustrophobic. It's a lot of fun in the first opening hour, though. So don't be shy on that account. And then on Saturday and Sunday, the first hour or so is usually pretty easy. Then after three, it gets to where it's comfortable again. So if you're crowd adverse, come after four on Friday, after three on Saturday and Sunday, and you'll be quite comfortable.
And there's food there.
Oh, yeah. So we have a food court, and there's Asian food and Happy Campers is coming this year, and she's a new vendor who serves these nutritious bowls of food, beans and rice, and several choices, also a Mexican dish. And then we have waffles and warm pretzels and ice cream, and the espresso booth is a big one for all of us who have to be there. So if you're just accompanying a shopper, you'll have a place to rest and get out of the crowd and have something to eat.
B. Metcalf, thank you for coming down. Now we get to talk to
the important ones here, these three young women who are so impressive.
Molly, Rucci, and Salve, thanks for coming down to the station.
Yeah.
So can you describe what you're producing?
Well, most of our jewelry is sterling silver or copper, and they're earrings. We have some bracelets, and those are made out of beads. There's glass beads, plastic beads, you know, all different types.
What gives you the inspiration for the designs that you're doing?
We normally really just try out what we think might look cool. Sometimes we'll see a cool idea on a magazine, or we'll see a shape that we like on a sign.
How many pieces are you making for the public market?
Over 300.
How long does it take you to make each piece?
It depends on the piece. Some of the metal ones take up to 40 minutes, and then there's others that take only 10.
What's the process of making them?
To make a beaded earring, you need your head pins, which is what all the beads go on. And so then you have to figure out what design you want to make. And so you pick out the beads that you like, and you say, oh, I think these would go nice together, and you try. And it's really just trial and error until you find a design that you like. And then you put a ear wire on it, which is what goes into your ear. And that's how I make my beaded earring.
Do you all have the same design, or do you do something different?
No, I kind of do what she does, the same process.
What's the price range?
Our price range is like $5 to $40, but we only have a few that are $40.
Is this your first time at the public market?
Yes, it is.
What are you doing to get ready for it, other than making lots and lots of jewelry?
Well, we are sort of learning more and more about the public market as we go along. And we're getting more, we're, like, finding chairs that we want. We have to find our chairs. And we have a table. And we're really just, we're pretty ready so far.
Do you know where you're going to be in Centennial Hall?
Yes, we're going to be in the Hickel Room.
Cool. Anything you want to add? I want to talk to Peter, if I could, because is the Arts Council open? Is it Jack?
Yes, we have another 40 vendors in the Juneau Arts and Culture Center. These girls are in the Hickel Room, just off the admissions lobby. And so we have all the meeting rooms in Centennial Hall filled with vendors, as well as the another 40 vendors at the Jack, which, by the way, there's no admission charge at the Jack. There is a $7 weekend pass for the Centennial Hall.
All right. Well, I want to thank my jewelry makers for coming down the station today and having fun on the radio. Anything you want to add, my friend, to ask?
I don't think so. Rudy?
No, I think we're good.
All right. Thanks for coming down.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 23rd of November, 2016. Today is the birthday, we believe, of Henry McCarty, better known as Billy the Kid, New York City, 1859. That's according to the book that made the kid famous after he died, a book entitled The Authentic Life of Billy the Kid by Pat Garrett and Ash Upson. He was born in New York City to an Irish immigrant family. His mother, Catherine, was a widow. At some point, she moved her two sons, Henry and Joe, to Indianapolis, then to Wichita in 1870. It was a very rough pioneer town. She did pretty well there. She opened a laundry business. It was successful. She dabbled in real estate, tried to give her son some education. But Wichita was still wild. There were horse thieves and outlaws riding in and out. Murder was commonplace. And then she came down with tuberculosis. She moved her family out to New Mexico, and her tuberculosis got worse, and she died, leaving her boys to fend for themselves. They tried to make do. Billy the Kid's first crime was just stealing some butter from a farmer, but then he fell in with a thief known as Sombrero Jack, and he was arrested, Billy the Kid, for stealing laundry. He needed the clothing. He was sent off to jail. He escaped from jail, and his outlaw life began. He was about 15 years old. He was small. He was youthful-looking. An acquaintance described Billy the Kid as a short, slender young man with large front teeth, giving a chronic grin to his expression. So he stole horses, he rustled cattle, and then he got involved in a feud there in Lincoln County, New Mexico, the Lincoln County War. He was working for a man named John Tunstall. He'd hired him as a ranch hand, and Billy the Kid fought to defend his boss. There were murders on both sides, and Billy the Kid was arrested by Pat Garrett, who was the sheriff of Lincoln County, put him in jail. The Kid escaped. Pat Garrett tracked him down to Fort Sumner and shot him and killed him. There was nothing about him that made him stand out from other outlaws of his day, but there was the book that was written about him, The Authentic Life of Billy the Kid, which made him famous. A charming young outlaw, according to a man named Frank Coe, who said he was about 17, 5 feet 8 inches, weighed 138 pounds, stood straight as an Indian, fine-looking lad, a ladies' man. The Mexican girls were all crazy about him. He spoke their language well. He was a fine dancer. He was a wonder. You would have been proud to know him. Here's a poem for today, four limericks, Q-R-S-T. There was an old lady of Queens who survived on wieners and beans, wearing army surplus, riding the bus, and stealing from vending machines. A misanthrope living in Raleigh believed human friendship was folly, but he did get it on with a trumpeter swan and was fond of a miniature collie. An old fellow lived in St. James, whose parents were in silver frames, and looked down from the wall, and if he swore at all, their pictures burst into flames. An old fellow up in Two Harbors, no longer bothered with barbers, he let his hair grow 10 feet or so and wore it on overhead arbors. Four limericks by Gary Johnson, used by permission of the poet, here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by WordPress.com, where millions go to share their passions on personal and professional blogs. Now offering custom .blog domain names, WordPress.com. And by the Poetry Foundation. You can subscribe to the Poetry Magazine podcast and the Poetry Off the Shelf podcast in the iTunes Store or listen at poetryfoundation.org. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
Support comes from Northern Audiology and Hearing Services in the Jordan Creek Center. Northern Audiology offers diagnostic medical hearing expertise and digital technology hearing instruments. 789-6780.
It's 24 minutes after the hour, and you are tuned into Juno Afternoon. Our next guest is Lindsay Burnett from Bustinow Boutiques, here to talk about the Downtown Business Association and the various things they got going up this holiday season. Lindsay, thanks for coming down.
Thanks for having me. I'm real pleased to be here.
So can you give me a description of the DBA, please?
The DBA is the Downtown Business Association. It's a nonprofit group that's comprised of a number of businesses downtown, and it's all about bringing community downtown and helping people feel comfortable and really welcome the downtown environment, from legislators to the tourists to our awesome locals.
And you've been in the Bustinow Boutique.
I do. I am one of the co-owners of Bustinow Boutique. My business partner, Hollis, is manning the shop like a valiant person right now, getting ready for our Donuts and Deals event and the Pajama Jammy Jam that we're throwing with the Senate building.
The Jammy Jam?
Pajama Jammy Jam.
You have to educate me a little bit more on that, please.
So that is an event that started off with the Seaside Yarns owner, Missy, and she has been doing it for a number of years. We kind of jumped on the bandwagon last year, and now this year the entire second floor and the first floor of the Senate Mall is going to be participating in the Pajama Jammy Jam, as well as the Donuts and Deals that the DBA is putting on. So.
And this is all happening?
This is all happening Black Friday starting at 8 a.m., and it will be going till we run out of donuts, we run out of deals, and we run out of time in the day.
What other things do you have planned for the DBA?
DBA has a lot going on this year. It's doing a number of different events. I think there's just about one every weekend after Gallery Walk. There's something that's very akin to the Women, Wine, and Wish List that'll be going on, and then the kind of infamous day of a gift in the hand is better than one in the mail, so we'll have lots of people doing that. For Gallery Walk, they're trying to get some good things going on. They're going to be closing down Front Street again and having DJ Manu come up and being a DJ, obviously. And then we'll have some prizes and some giveaways and a holiday festive sweater contest, and everyone's welcome to participate. There's going to be the different categories inside of that, where the festive holiday sweater, the ugly holiday sweater, et cetera, et cetera. What else? There's lots going on. They're just always trying to be busy and really promote downtown as a great place to come and shop and see your local people who are really trying to make it thrive and be a sustainable place to live.
Do you have a website?
We do. Busnetboutique.com, or are you talking about the DBA?
Well, you just got that one by, so let's do the DBA.
DBA does have one. And for shame on me, I believe it's downtownbusinessassociation.com. You can find it on Google. It's a really informative website. There's always a list of events that are going on and a lot of different activities, not just put on by the DBA. Some of them are other members. But really, it's just a great place to go and find something from a local that you know and that loves you and loves to give back to the community.
All right, Lindsay Burnett, thanks for coming out. Tell me where Busnet Boutique is located.
Busnet Boutique is located on the second floor of the Senate Mall, and we have all the big three windows that face the atrium, so you can really see us great. One quick thing about Gallery Walk, we're going to have Martha's Flowers there to have an amazing display, so everybody should come check that out, see what she can do, and she can be really creative with some beautiful florals.
Lindsay, thanks for coming down.
Thank you.
Nothing creepy, always behind me. Spirits I can't see, but I feel the energy. When I speak out, no one believes. No predicting thing is easy. Is what you want. True and faithful. Run, 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 run.
Tuned into a June afternoon. Our next guests are Seth Casey and Sarah Mertz. Thank you for coming down to the station today. Here to talk about the Glacier Swim Club. Tell me about the club, please.
Glacier Swim Club is it's kind of like a Parks and Rec team. It's a community team of over 200 kids, ranging from 5 to 18 years old. We practice morning and night.
What are the major activities other than just swimming?
For me, I've been involved with swimming since I was 5, but then also at school, I'm in Student Council and National Honor Society and activities like that. I've also tried out softball, but I'm not very coordinated, so I've stuck to swimming.
Is it really true that there are different strokes for different folks?
There are. I mean, I've never been able to swim breaststroke very well, but I've figured out how to swim backstroke and other strokes. But, yeah, some people like certain strokes better than others.
What's your favorite?
Backstroke.
Backstroke. Mm-hmm. Is that something you have to practice a lot with?
Yeah, they all take a lot of time to master.
And Seth, are you a coach?
Yeah, I've been a coach with Glacier Swim Club for 4 years now. So,
what's the first thing you tell your swimmers when they get in the water?
The first thing I'm
try your best, really. You know, as long as you have fun with it, really. I think that's the biggest thing, is have fun with it. You know, if you're not having fun, then you shouldn't be there.
How often are the meets scheduled?
There's a meet at least once a month, sometimes twice a month, depending on what meets you go to. We have time trials that are just for GSC here in town, at least, you know, once a month, once every 6 weeks kind of thing. So,
which pool do you usually swim in?
Mainly Diamond Park, just because it's bigger. We can hold a lot more people out there. There's 8 lanes as opposed to 6 downtown. But every once in a while, there are time trials downtown.
And you've got some fundraising activities coming up.
For Glacier Swim Club, our biggest fundraiser is not till the springtime, which is Aqualapse.
Are you doing Christmas trees?
Well, yeah, Christmas trees are actually the high school swim team, so it's a little bit different. Glacier Swim Club is a little different than the high school teams. High school season runs from the beginning of August to the first weekend in November, and both high school teams, JD and TM, we do a fundraiser for selling Christmas trees over at Fred Meyer's, and that helps. You know, I mean, we bring in, I think there's, you know, close to $8,000, something like that, for selling Christmas trees, and that goes to our high school swim team. So it's not actually part of GSC, but I would say 90 to 95% of the high school swimmers are a product of GSC. So,
why do you swim? What satisfaction do you get out of it?
Why do I swim? I don't swim anymore. I coach, but
Sarah, how about you?
I'm
trying to get something philosophical.
Yes, I think I started swimming when I was 5. And I joined the team because my older sister was on the team, and I wanted to do everything that my older sister did. I think that's kind of a common theme that little sisters have of their older sister. So I wanted to be just like her. And then when I started swimming, and I just kind of got hooked on it, and then it really does become part of the team is like your family. You become really close to the people there, your coaches. You admire the people that you spend hours and hours every week with, and so you just keep coming back to want to spend time with your coaches and your teammates, the people that are there every day with you. So the family and the team aspect of it is what always brought me back to go back for another year.
Cool. So when is your next meet?
For Glacier Swim Club, the next meet would be first weekend of December. It's our Southeast Championship meet. All the Southeast teams, so you've got Petersburg, Ketchikan, Sitka, Craig, and then obviously us. We're hosting that out of Diamond Park. That's the first week of December. And that's kind of it's a championship meet. It's the lowest qualifying championship meet that you can attend. But we have the majority of our team going to that meet, and it's a pretty big one, and we're pretty stoked for it coming up here.
Cool. All right, Seth Casey and Sarah Mertz, anything you'd like to add on what I forgot to ask? I guess that's a no. Thanks for coming down.
Thank you for having us.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
support comes from the Alaska Robotics Gallery, offering art that features narwhals, squid, and flying whales, located at 220 Front Street in downtown Juneau. More information at alaskarobotics.com.
This is Bird Note. There used to be a saying about somebody who doesn't eat much. She eats like a bird, just a little of this and a smidgen of that. But how much does a bird typically eat? And how much would you have to eat to match it? Well, depends on the bird. As a rule of thumb, the smaller the bird, the more food it needs relative to its weight. A Cooper's hawk, a medium-sized bird that hunts other birds, eats around 12% of its weight per day. For you, if you weigh, say, 150 pounds, that's 18 pounds of chow, roughly 6 extra large pizzas. That perky little chickadee flitting back and forth for sunflower seeds from your feeder eats the equivalent of 35% of its weight. You, as a 150-pound chickadee, will be munching 600 granola bars a day. And a tiny hummingbird? It drinks about 100% of its body weight per day. That means you'll be sipping 17.5 gallons of milk. Prefer wine or beer? 18 gallons. If it's warm outside, you can probably get by on a bit less. But if it's cold, you'll need more. So you'd best stock up. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
It's about 20 minutes before the air, and you're tuned into it in the afternoon. Our next guest in the studio is Linda Nicklin and Philip Nilken. They're doing a presentation at the Menzel Glacier Visitor Center this Friday about their trip through the Northwest Passage. Philip and Linda, thank you very much for coming down to the station.
Thank you.
That's
for
great
having
to see
us.
You, Jeff.
So, this was not just a normal cruise. You went on a summer cruise to through the Inside Passage.
Yeah, it wasn't normal in many ways. It was the biggest passenger ship to go through, about 1,000 guests on board, and it was sort of exciting. Going in, visiting communities, sort of emerging between luxury cruising and expedition travel, and going and doing some new stuff. So yeah, it was very exciting.
You went on a 32-day cruise on the Crystal Serenity.
Yeah, 32 days. Yeah, exactly, from Seward to New York City, and lots of stops in between.
How did it all come about?
They started thinking about the trip about 4 years before we actually went at Crystal Cruise Lines, trying to figure out if it was possible, and about a year into that process, ended up hiring an organization called Expedition Voyages, which are experts at expedition travel, and particularly in high latitude areas of the Earth. And they worked on planning for the trip for the years before we went. We were hired a couple of years before the trip to be part of a 40-person team of expedition staff. So that was everything from lecturers on board, historians, naturalists, photographers like Flip that were giving talks on board about some of the areas we were traveling to Zodiac drivers and helicopter pilots and kayak guides and everything to provide all of the expedition aspects of the voyage.
I mean, being a naturalist is not new to you, because you do it on board guests, no guiding vessels. And Flip, you're internationally renowned photographer.
I think exactly. I came on, and I really didn't put it together until I started getting ready for the trip. But I had done 10 National Geographic stories along the route the trip was going to take. And so very much what I was doing was telling stories and relating what I'd done up there and what I'd seen, what I'd photographed to people. The interesting part is almost all my stuff was done on ice. And this trip was all about wouldn't have been happening if there was that kind of ice as we traveled.
Was it safe?
Was it safe?
Yeah.
You know, my mother read a story in the Wall Street Journal and called me and said, is it safe what you're doing going up there? I said, Mom, you know, what you didn't say anything about living in a tent in polar bear country for months at a time. This is not just safe, it was luxurious. It was very, very well thought out.
What about the passengers? Are they different from a normal cruise ship passenger?
You know, I don't know. I've never been on a normal cruise ship. But I think they were, there's 1,000 people. And so there are people who were really interested in our part of the expedition, other people that were playing bridge and doing other things. But I think there were an awful lot of people that would have been very at home in a regular expedition ship, and a number of people who had been on expedition ships as well as doing this. An awful lot of people were there just because it was a first. It was the first time the big ship going through the whole way, and the historical element was not lost on anybody.
At the same time, the atmosphere on the ship was very different within the ship from a smaller expedition style voyage, in that they had their full complement of entertainments, you know, shows at every evening, musicians in different venues playing, ballroom dancing classes, yoga classes, workshops on, you know, photography and various things that people could learn and do, and you know, a lot of different options for eating and drinking and that kind of thing. So there probably were, we tended to interact most with the people who were getting out hiking and kayaking and coming to lectures and everything, but there probably were a number of people that most of their focus was on those things that were happening within the ship.
You're accompanied by a Canadian icebreaker. Yeah. Did you have to do any icebreaking?
Yes, we were accompanied, and no, we didn't have to do any ice breaking. In fact, we had to go looking for ice on this particular voyage because in order to try to see some of the wildlife that's around ice edges.
What kind of wildlife did you see?
The very best and most exciting was in Victoria Strait. We saw a lot of polar bears on the broken up ice that we were floating off the edge of. So that was the most exciting. I got to lead some hikes, so I got glimpses of some of the terrestrial wildlife, like Arctic foxes and hares and snowy owls and a lot of great bird life, both from the ship and from shore. And then we saw whales, we saw some bowhead whales and
humpbacks and fins and sais and, you know, whales along the way, a number of dolphins and stuff. It was on the big ship, you're sort of keeping the ship nice and safe and comfortable and going along, and it was not the kind of intimate wildlife watching you do on an expedition ship. It was a luxury cruise ship where you could get off and do some side things. And probably one of the best whale experiences, when we were in Greenland, folks were out on a fishing trip and had humpbacks all around them and stuff. So it was all there. But this was much more the cruise through the Northwest Passage than a wildlife photography type of situation.
Mm-hmm. Talk to me a little bit about the cultural sensitivity of the trip.
Well, I think they did a really good job. Well, for one thing, the only places we went were places where the communities were inviting us in. A number of the things that were talked about at the beginning were 1,000 people going into these small communities. That never happened. It was a small groups of people going at, I think, never more than about 200 people at a time. And the communities were really involved. I think it worked out really well. And there were a lot of really great exchanges between people in the communities and guests off the ships. And people from the communities were also brought onto the ship. And some of the really fun stuff were people who came on board this beautiful, really fancy cruise ship and wandering around and talking to people and going to the ice cream bar and some of the things they had on the ship that were not available in some of these small communities. So it was, I think it worked out very, very well.
What's the price range for a trip like this?
I think double occupancy range from around $20,000 to around $120,000. And there was a wide range in the...
Per person.
I mean, per person, yes.
Were the other passengers really aware of... This is like a once-in-a-lifetime trip.
I think so. I think it really was I think they did a really good job of telling people what they were going to be doing. And I think when they brought the ship up, the trip up immediately, it was sold out. But they made a real, it seemed like a real effort to tell people what they were doing, what they weren't doing. And I think a number of people backed out, but there was such a long waiting list, everybody filled it in. So it was full. But I think the people who came along really knew where they were going and what they were going to do.
You say you saw polar bears. Were there any standout moments that happened that impressed you as well as the visitors?
Yeah. The wildlife-wise, there was just the idea that you have polar bears wandering around the ice in this big ship in the background. It was a long way away. The big ship was not close to where we were. What was exciting is they had a Cineflex system on the ship, and I wondered how they were going to handle that. But they had one of these gyro-stabilized long lens cameras they use in football games and things like that. So even when polar bears were hundreds of yards away, they could show really good clear pictures to people in the ship of what they were seeing. So people could look up with binoculars and see the little white dots and see full frame of that on widescreen TVs around the ship and see, you know, so mothers and cubs swimming through the ice, they were getting a clearer view. They did a really good job. They mixing the expedition elements with luxury, comfortable cruising, it was a challenge. I think they carried it off really well.
You're talking this Friday at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center about your experiences. What kind of things, besides what we talked about this afternoon, that you'd bring up then?
Well, this at the talk, we'll be telling some stories from the trip and trying to give people a sense of what it was like to be on this trip. And also putting it a little bit in context of, you know, what's happening with Arctic tourism, what's likely to come next to some degree, what some of the challenges and issues are. But it's mostly a talk about this trip to give people a chance to sit in the theater out there at the Mendenhall Visitor Center and have an experience of being on the Northwest Passage on the Crystal Serenity to some degree.
And normally when they do the fireside lectures, there's two shows, but this is just one show at 7 o'clock?
That's right, just one at 7 o'clock.
And it's free. What impressed you most about the adventure you had?
I think what impressed me was the level of speakers on board and the level of interest in... We had the main auditorium where you gave talks was about 500 people, and it would be full. And they had, like, Henry Pollard, you know, talking about climate change and ice, who works with Al Gore. There were... usually you have one or two people who are sort of the specialty heavyweights on a tour, and there must have been 20 on this that were really, really experts in their field, birders or different elements of geologists that were along. And the questions were great. Going along, and it's funny, this is the kind of trip where people, if you tell people, did you hear about that trip that went through the Northwest Passage, they sort of have a sneer and go, yeah, I heard about that. And I said, well, I was on that trip. And then they try and back off and go, well, how was it? But it was great. And to be exposed to that many people and people who are going to very likely be make an influence in their community when they go back and tell them the stories we have to tell was just a great experience. And the questions and the interest of these people was wonderful.
I'm talking to Linda Nicklin. They're doing a presentation this Friday night at 7 o'clock at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. They're in Naturalist on the first major cruise ship, the Crystal Serenity, to navigate the previously frozen Northwest Passage since last August. They went from Seward to New York, 32 days long. The Canadian icebreaker was how far away from you?
Well, was it Canadian or was it UK?
Yeah, it's a UK registered, but we were accompanied by it just in Canada and Greenland. So they met us as we came across the border into Canadian waters. The icebreaker met us
And for that entire time that we were off the coast of Canada and then across to Greenland, we explored some places in western Greenland. The icebreaker was generally within sight of the Crystal Serenity and sometimes essentially alongside, and that particularly when we were using the Zodiacs and the kayaks and the helicopters were all carried on the icebreaker. So if we had an expedition stop somewhere to get people off the ship, we would use all the resources of the icebreaker for that.
Do you think this is a sign of the future?
I do think this is a sign of the future. And I know that there are a number of cruise companies that are purpose-building expedition cruise ships to go to the Arctic. So Hurtigruten is, for example, right now building two hybrid ships that will carry around 500 passengers specifically to explore Arctic areas, and other cruise lines are bringing more vessels online. So I think there's a lot of interest in visiting the Arctic, and there's a lot of opportunity with the decrease in sea ice and waterways opening up. So I think it is a sign of the future in some ways.
I imagine there are a lot of discussions about global warming.
There were a lot of discussions about that, and we were fortunate, as Flip said, to have a couple of some real expertise on board that could give people details about what's known in about global warming, and particularly in the Arctic, where it's happening more rapidly than on other parts of the planet.
Are you ready to go again?
I'm ready.
Well, you can help. Listen, it's Friday night at 7 o'clock at the Mineral and Glacier Visitor Center, Flint and Linda Nicklin. We're talking about their 32-day adventure from Seward to New York along the Northwest Passage. Anything you'd like to add, I might have forgotten to ask.
The elevators don't work at right now, so be aware when you show up, and we hope to see a bunch of friends out there, and bring your questions. I know there's lots of questions. There's a lot of stuff floating around the trip, and we'd love to address those and tell you what we know.
7 o'clock this Friday. Thanks so much.
Thanks,
for coming.
Thank you.
hour, 2 minutes before the hour, and you are tuned into Juno Afternoon. Coming up tomorrow on Juno Afternoon, for tomorrow, My Life as a Wild Turkey. It joins other Thanksgiving-related programmings. 10 o'clock, Turkey Confidential. For the forecast for tonight, patchy fog, freezing fog with numerous snow showers, little or no snow accumulation expected, low temperatures around 30 degrees. Forecast for Thanksgiving Day, cloudy skies, patchy freezing fog with isolated snow showers. Thursday night, scattered snow showers with low temperatures in the mid-20s. Forecast for Friday, numerous rain showers and scattered snow showers, high temperatures around 40 degrees.